I haven't got a story, but I do want to start by having you all imagining you were asked to design a city. Where would you start? Perhaps with its layout, its major features, its roads? Would you use a shape? What shape might that be? Perhaps shaped like a bird? Well, such a city with that layout exists. It's called Brasilia, and it is the capital of Brazil. Now, you might have thought Brazil's capital was Rio de Janeiro, and indeed it was until 1960. But as a coastal city, Rio was seen as vulnerable to attack. And in fact, Brazil's constitution, dating back to 1891, stated that the capital should be moved to a more central location. But it wasn't until this gentleman here, Juscelino Kubitschek, became president in 1956, that its construction would finally be ordered. His election campaign promised 50 years of progress in five, and building a new capital was one of his key pledges. Yet while the constitution mandated moving the capital to the centre of the country for defensive reasons, that didn't really make much sense in the 1950s. Really, moving the city at this point was more of a political gesture. It was a sign that the country was ready to move on from its colonial past. A modern new capital would launch Brazil onto the world stage as an optimistic and forward-looking power. Now, Kubitschek invited the architect Oscar Niemeyer to design the new capital's civic buildings, such as the Presidential Palace and National Congress, Supreme Court, etc. And Niemeyer's friend Lúcio Costa won the contest to arrange its layout, and he is the person responsible for that bird-like plan. Now, beyond acting as a symbol for a braver, more optimistic age, they actually believed they could design a new city that would transform Brazil's heavily stratified society into a more egalitarian one. In their model utopia, they envisaged governors and ambassadors living next door to janitors and labourers. Everyone would use the same spaces and entrances, and everyone would live happily together. Now, Niemeyer and Costa had worked together on a number of projects previously. Both admire their contemporary, the Swiss-French architect Le Corbusier, who was the pioneer of modern urbanism. Le Corbusier believed that good architecture could produce good societies, and he advocated ideas like organizing cities around rigid zones with different activities taking place in different areas, and lifting residential areas above the ground and letting cars and services run underneath. So with Brazil's vast and unpopulated interior as their canvas, Costa and Niemeyer set to work, and they used some of Le Corbusier's ideas as the basis for their new city. And from Brazil's barren central plateau, a new city emerged. And what a city. With Costa's logical plan and Niemeyer's distinctive buildings, Brasilia is considered a definitive example of 20th century modernist urban planning, and the city received UNESCO World Heritage status in 1987. Yet, as much as it can be admired as a work of art, it basically fails as somewhere you'd want to live. For example, Costa's fixed layout limited the amount of residential space that was available. So as people moved to the city and searched for work, its population grew rapidly, and very soon, Brazil's deep class structures, which had subtle racial origins, reasserted themselves. The workers who had built the city would be banished to distant satellite towns and be segregated from the middle classes. And they would spend much of their meagre salaries on the long commutes into and out of the city. Now, my brother actually lives in Brazil, and I asked him recently, I said, what's people's general impression of Brasilia? And he told me most see it as basically a city for the rich, built by the rich, which is quite a bit different from those aspirations of Costa and Niemeyer. In 1982, the art critic Robert Hughes said,
"Nothing dates faster than people's fantasies about the future. This is what you get when perfectly decent, intelligent and talented men start thinking in terms of space rather than place, and about single rather than multiple meanings. It's what you get when you design for political aspirations and not real human needs. You get miles of jerry-built platonic nowhere infested with Volkswagens. This, one may fervently hope, is the last experiment of its kind. The utopian buck stops here.
I want to be Robert Hughes when I grow up. There's a lot to unpack in that critique, but whenever I hear it, I do wonder if similar criticisms could be levelled at our own work. We've certainly adopted the modernist aesthetic, with the trend away from decorative and experimental towards more of the minimalistic and apparently material, truthful interface design. But are we also adapting the same detached optimism that failed the citizens of Brasilia? In 2011, Marc Andreessen penned an essay for the Wall Street Journal in which he suggested that every company needed to become a software company for it to remain relevant. Now, as the cost of hardware has decreased and processes have become ever more powerful, services that have traditionally been delivered by other means are now being run by software and delivered online. We're really in the midst of an economical and technological shift in which technology companies, fueled by network effects and limitless venture capital, are taking over large parts of our economy. And given this emphasis on technology and on software, Silicon Valley has become an outsized influence. And so has its culture. This is one that stands at the altar of computation, and where the only law that matters is that of more, and everything can be reduced to a series of ones and zeros. I hope you're enjoying your popcorn. Now, given this abundance of technology, the distinguishing factor has become design. No longer considered simply an act of applying a veneer towards the end of a product's development, design is considered an integral part of that development. Those working in the industry are told that they can make an impact on millions, if not billions, of people's lives. And people often cite this as a reason for joining companies like Facebook and Google. Personally, I find that idea deeply distressing, but I may be in a narrow majority of that view. But designers now have a seat at the table. Some of the biggest players in the valley remain led by domineering CEOs with engineering backgrounds, though. I wonder if designers have as much influence as they like to think. Now, for me, there's no better example of this than when the Yahoo logo was announced, 5 years ago. Its former CEO, Marissa Mayer, famously talked about how her and a small team of in-house designers had come up with it in an afternoon. And you can tell. I wonder if they also tested 41 shades of purple as well. So needing to qualify subjective decisions is not a new problem for designers. Indeed, they've made it an art form in itself, post-rationalisation. But not a day goes past in which a logo isn't justified in terms of how it fits within a particular grid, I believe is indicative of a trend in which design needs to be seen as somehow mathematically pure. And yet design is an incredibly intuitive act. It involves making decisions that seemingly go against logic, but make sense when you consider how humans perceive things in the real world. So take this example of a play icon. Now, the triangle looks slightly off-centre, but if we inspect its position, it's entirely centred within the circle. Now, a designer, exercising her own judgment, will move it slightly to the right to make the composition feel a bit more balanced. Now, you might be thinking, surely we can use AI, machine learning, other new buzzwords to solve these decisions. So here, a computer could understand where the mass of the triangle lay within the circle and adjust its placements accordingly. Now, while it's certainly true that many decisions may not be as subjective as designers like to think they are, would it not be a damning indictment of our species if we were to surrender individualism and creativity to algorithms and machines? Another example of how software engineering practice has led the way is around workflow. The Agile Manifesto is a product of software delivery, and it's a process in which designers are often asked to slot into. Countless designers, such as my former colleague here, John Hazelwood, will talk about the difficulty of making decisions or being able to look holistically at problems when the process demands small pieces of separated work. Now, I don't want to get into arguments about Agile. For that, there's actually an account online you can follow. It's at Andy Budd. Jeremy told me not to make any jokes, but I think that one, does that pass? No comment. Ah, oh, good. I like being crap at comedy. It's a Yes. Anyway, this is indicative of a trend. Ideas around minimum viability and company principles such as move fast and break things or always be hustling, they prioritise speed of delivery and often at the expense of the side effects, which may be around quality or taking the time to consider the consequences of releasing a particular feature. And finally, there's this compulsive deference to data. Now, clearly, there's a spectrum between having data-informed design decisions and dictating them. Yet the trend is always towards collecting more data, not less. Yet having more data may actually be limiting the options available. It can lead us to make incremental changes and optimise within local maximums rather than seeking out entirely new approaches. And designing at the scale of populations, it's easy to make generalisations. When users are reduced merely to data points, real-life situations are seen as edge cases. Now, you may argue this is a simplistic outlook, and you're probably right. Nothing is black and white, everything is shades of grey. But that's kind of my point. Now, clearly, the pendulum is swinging from a spec-driven waterfall process in which developers are asked to chop up pristine Photoshop comps that have been thrown over the wall by an interaction-illiterate designer, and they're moving more towards collaborative, systematic, and rationalised approaches. And that's great, that really is. But my fear is that maybe this pendulum is starting to swing too far in the opposite direction. The shadow Silicon Valley casts over those building digital products is long and unavoidable. It's become sort of the invisible hand that shapes our tools and defines the boundaries within which we practice. It forces us to concern ourselves with the road ahead when sometimes we just need to pull over and take a good, long, hard look at where we're headed. Now, in an attempt to understand our work, digital designers will often look towards architectural practice for inspiration. Those familiar with the history of responsive design will know that Ethan arrived at the name after looking at responsive architecture, a practice which seeks to design buildings that react according to their environment and adapt to the needs of those inhabiting them. And as we heard from Ellen earlier, much of the thinking around design systems and software architecture can trace its history back to the writing of architect Christopher Alexander. But as much as we can learn from where architecture has been successful, lessons can also be drawn from its many failures as well. Now, I had the good fortune of visiting Brasilia in 2011. And while I was there, I observed a number of repeating architectural motifs that were used by Niemeyer in his buildings that lend the city its unique identity. So the use of these wing-like stilts that suspend buildings there, reflection in water, often dramatic sloping entrances into and out of buildings, and of course Niemeyer's signature bold use of curves, often used in contrast with elongated straight lines. As a city designed to invoke a modern, forward-looking Brazil, these motifs helped give this capital its very distinctive, identifiable, and cohesive presence. Yet while Niemeyer's buildings are really beautiful objects, they do tend to suffer an emphasis on form over function. For example, this building is the National Congress, and has this ramp at the front. Now, it looks like the entrance, but in fact it's purely decorative, a point reinforced by the barrier that's been placed halfway up it, and the fact that the roof is occupied by armed guards. Costa's layout suffers similarly. Now, along the main axis here, you've got these large lawns, and while I'm sure these were designed to satisfy an objective of, you know, providing open space for people to relax and play in, their simplistic placement didn't really consider that, in fact, to reach them, you need to cross six lanes of traffic. Built around the car, distances between different buildings are quite long. Everything just sort of feels a bit disconnected. All the things make sense in isolation, but they don't work when put together. Now you can drink. So Brad Frost's atomic design is a popular model for thinking about the construction of UI. And to his credit, he takes into account, you know, the thing we actually need to deliver at the end of the day is templates and pages. And yet, a focus always seems to be drawn to the smaller parts than the whole. I've heard more discussion about whether something is an atom, a molecule, or an organism than anything regarding templates or pages. Maybe the metaphor helps us at one level, but it hinders understanding at another. And our favourite go-to analogy is Lego, take another drink. Now, while it remains as a sort of useful idea of communicating the idea of modularised, extensible and controlled systems, I think two important aspects are often missed. The first one is there's enormous variety of different brick shapes. Some, if you look at models today, you know, quite customised, detailed brick shapes. But the reason this variety can exist is that there's the predictability of the underlying system, of the tubes and the stubs, and the metrics in which these bricks have to work within. So one of the first bricks produced in 1958 will connect with one that's produced just today. I often wonder, what are the underlying methods of that enable consistency and predictable means of connection in our own work? Perhaps it's the story, as we heard earlier, or maybe it's something more tangible, I don't know. Now, if I'm honest, I think the discussion around design systems is starting to suffer a little from a lack of clarity. Terms like style guide, component library, design language, visual language, these all get used interchangeably when more formal definitions are possible. It's hard, naming things is hard, yes, but also sticking to the same names is harder even further. But there is a confusion, I think, between patterns and components, and there are definitions around these things. As Nathan Curtis pointed out, a pattern is a generalised set of abstract principles and guidance required to solve a particular problem. More documentation than code, it's kind of the why of a design system. The components are specific instances of user interface, implemented in code and user-facing. They're kind of the what. So most of the pattern libraries that we're sharing are, in fact, component libraries. As domain-specific entities, they're quite possibly less useful outside the organisations that built them than pattern libraries could be, as they can help others solve problems that are conceptually similar. So I'm starting to wonder if this confusion has bled into our tools. Whenever I look to create or document a design system, I end up using tools like Fractal, which you've heard about, Fabricator, Pattern Lab, etc. But these all design primarily around a single entity, the component. And their ergonomics subconsciously encourage a modularized approach and a strict focus on code. That's to be expected, of course, they're component library tools, but it's sort of worth remembering that when approaching it with a design systems mindset. Now, I know Vitaly Friedman has talked in the past about maybe presenting design systems sort of that starts with the interfaces and templates and pages first, and then you can sort of zoom down and see how they're all nested together, and I think there's some mileage in that idea. But as the line between component libraries and much broader systems for design continues to blur, we need to ensure that our tools are up to the job. Do we adapt component-based tools to take into account for wider concerns, or do we look to entirely new tools? I'm actually reminded of talks Jeremy gave back in the day about how where Photoshop would ask you for image dimensions before starting on a new document, and how that kind of informed our early approach to design for the web, thinking that we could sort of approach it with fixed canvases. I think we need to be careful we don't make similar mistakes when building tools to construct design systems. After all, small choices have larger impacts than we might imagine. Now, consistency has come up a few times today. But what do we mean when we say consistency? Do we mean something else, perhaps? Now, while people with minimalist sensibilities like myself certainly enjoy the design of Brasilia from a distance, for residents it's seen as a somewhat sterile and inhumane place to live. In fact, many people tend to leave the city at the weekend and head for the more vibrant cities of Rio and Sao Paulo. Modernist approaches espouse rationalism and formality, yet humans tend to be attracted more to things that are slightly off balance and not symmetrical. So is our desire to achieve rigid conformity ill-placed? Design systems are advocated in part because they encourage consistency, both in terms of code and visual appearance. But if everyone is looking to the same sources of inspiration, relying on the same frameworks, is it really any wonder we ended up at the point where websites are becoming sterile imitations of each other? Are we starting to confuse consistency with coherence and with conformance even? Now, Chris Pierce wrote an article about approaching vertical spacing in components in sort of systematic manner. It's a really great article. I can share it later. It's quite detailed. It outlines three different approaches to managing space in a componentized system. And all three approaches have their drawbacks, and they all kind of introduce a degree of complexity. And as I read this article, I couldn't help but think there might be just an example of taking things a little bit too far. Is complexity the price we need to pay to achieve consistency? What struck me in particular about the example Chris cited here, which is the sort of profile block on GitHub, and I appreciate it's just one example to illustrate his point, but taking this one example, it felt like actually a lot of the complexity there could be avoided if the right questions were asked. So quite often there's a dance between a developer and a designer, in which the developer is eager to replicate the work of the designer and take their work as gospel and replicate it in the best way they can. But if emphasis is placed on simply replicating how something looks, then the opportunity to understand any of the reasoning behind it may be lost. If questioning is less focused on what something looks like, but why, the designer may be able to provide a reasoning, hopefully should be able to provide a reasoning, and then that can be built into the system. Now, I think this is the most fruitful type of designer-developer relationship, questioning each other's assumptions and decisions and both sharing responsibility for the final result. Consistency can help interfaces be predictable and understandable. Yet much of this can come from the design fundamentals like colour, hierarchy, layout, and other aspects like well-written copy. I've lost track of the number of times in user testing where I'm painfully aware of all the visual discrepancies and things that they shouldn't look like that, but we just need to get it tested. But put it in front of a user and they're totally blind to all that stuff. They're just so focused on the task in hand. Returning to the example of Lego, the consistency in that product lies in that method of stubs and tubes, as well as a limited palette of colours and a set of standardised measurements which all bricks must adhere to. But beyond that, anything goes. And finally, I want to talk about when systems fail us. Now, after the Second World War, with local authorities facing housing shortages, many of Le Corbusier's ideas caught the imagination of town planners. They looked to high-density building types, be they tower blocks or streets in the sky, and sprawling estates in which homes could be accessed via raised decks. The motivation behind these building projects was really well-intentioned. These modern buildings would be a drastic improvement on the squalid slums that they replaced. Yet the need to build these new estates quickly, efficiently, and cheaply saw engineers look to modular building systems. One such technique, the large panel system, involved casting large concrete prefabricated sections and bolting them together on site. This was the construction method used at Roland Point. On the 16th of May 1968, an entire corner of this building collapsed in on itself after a resident lit a match to light her stove for a cup of tea. This sparked a gas explosion that blew out the load-bearing walls, which supported the four flats above, and as you can see, the whole entire corner of the building collapsed. Four people died and 17 people were injured. Now, this has horrible echoes of more recent tragedy at Grenfell Tower. Both events are the result of a failure within the design of a particular component or series of components, be that weak joints between prefabricated panels or the combustibility of materials used in cladding, and many other factors as well. But to understand why those components were chosen in the first place, you need to understand the culture in which those decisions were made. If a culture prioritises speed, cost and appearance over quality, value and suitability, then we need to be really mindful of the middle to long-term effects those decisions may have. Now, while the components we're building will not lead to physical harm, thank God, we know too well that digital products are capable of causing mental harm and distress. Thanks to projects like Dark Patterns, which documents how interfaces deliberately trick users into doing things they might otherwise want to, we have a pretty good idea of what user-hostile design looks like. Newer initiatives are raising awareness of the dangers of building products that constantly require our attention. One such initiative is Time Well Spent, and this asks designers to think how they might rethink product design and how we measure success so that we empower users rather than continually exploit them. I think there's an assumption that by building systems and breaking them down into smaller pieces, we can make them more maintainable, more understandable, more robust, more fault-tolerant, etc. But just ask anyone that had the unfortunate case of having a left pad module as an NPM dependency, you know, a couple of months ago, and that quickly falls apart. At CSS Day, a few weeks ago, in fact, Stephen Hay talked about the many ways CSS can be used for evil. And in his presentation, he noted that when systems become more complex, the number of possible weaknesses increases, yet become less apparent. So the more I work with design systems and listen to others talk about design systems, the more I realise that design, certainly in visual sense, is a really relatively minor concern. More often, it's the system that is the primary aspect. This introduces questions about process and organisation, about interactions between individuals and teams, about accountability and best practices. Design systems are an attempt to add a layer of logic and reasoning over a series of decisions made by complex, irrational, emotional human beings. As such, they're subject to individual perspectives, biases, and aspirations. So how does the culture in which they're made affect resulting decisions? How can you advocate for user advocacy or user agency in a culture that permits manipulating people's emotions without their consent? How do you approach the design just of a small search result component within an organisation that has a habit of abusing its near-monopoly position to distort markets in its favour? How do you craft tone of voice guidelines in a company that also produces guidance on how to refer to independent suppliers, such that their employment rights can be undermined? Ethan Marcotte. Every decision I make is shaped by my biases. Every decision I make is capable of harm. It's so, so easy to forget this, to focus on the layout challenge in front of me, to fulfill the client's latest request, or to meet a business goal. When I do these things, I occasionally forget to ask who will be impacted by my work. So style guides will mandate like the right way to use a logo, the right colours to use, and give strict guidance about sizing and presentation. Components can be designed in such a way that only certain variations are possible. So what if design systems, beyond aesthetic and code concerns, also took it upon themselves to provide guidance about how to craft interfaces that treat users with respect? What if they even made it harder to create such interfaces? So I want to leave you with this question. Who does your design system serve? Is it ultimately an inward-looking tool created in the service of organisational interests, where the focus is drawn down to the parts at the expense of the whole? Is it just the latest shiny thing to play around with to distract from bigger, uglier problems? Or does your design system encourage you to look outwards, a tool concerned not only with aesthetics, but ethics? The invisible yet invisible choices we make every day that affect the lives of those occupying the spaces we create. The choice is yours. The buck stops here. Thank you.